by this so-called pill mill going on here. It was an operation state police say they
not guilty for allegedly illegally prescribing hydrocodone and Adderall and doing so without proper patient
examination. Kentucky doctor who ran a pill mill is likely going to prison for the rest of his life.
But it was clear federal prosecutors thought that he was a drug dealer masquerading as a physician.
The doctor wrote more than 18,000 oxycodone prescriptions along with Adderall and other illegal drugs.
It appeared to be a one-man pill mill cranking out countless prescriptions for pain medication.
Behind me, shut down tonight after a raid, much to the surprise of many people who were in the waiting room waiting to see a doctor.
Welcome. I'm Ben Boyce. This is the Dr. Junkie Show. And today, I wanted to get back to our roots on this show, talking about the war on drugs and the way that our system is currently built to maximize the potential of addiction and the severity of addiction when it does show up. And it's getting worse. Amidst this overdose crisis that's killing something like 110,000 people every year because they're forced to buy drugs on the street from dangerous sources, they don't know how potent they are, they can't get help, many doctors are now adopting policies sending otherwise regular, non-problem-having drug users to the streets for their supply. See, I went to my regular family doctor like I used to every month or two to get my scripts refilled, asthma medication, minor painkiller, benzodiazepine, things my doctor's written me for years. But something changed in the middle of 2022. In my doctor, and as I would find out, lots of other doctors started adding additional policies and hoops that people have to jump through to get their medication. So with me, this started out of the blue. I went in to get my meds, and my doctor said, "Oh, I need you to take a drug test before you leave." If you've listened to this show, you know I have an ethical problem with drug tests. They put those of us who are smart enough or rich enough to beat them or lucky enough to pass them because we're not using a banned substance in a privileged position that makes the addiction crisis worse. Get your meds cut off and experience pain or violate your own principles. Quite a choice I had to make. And of course, I explained all this to her, and she seemed to be annoyed that I had the gall to say something. So I took the test, thinking I'll at least get out the door with my meds. And a week later, I got a bill in the mail for $150. I called and complained. I got a little bit of it waived. I was told that they wouldn't run the test like that unless they warned me about it next time. And I decided, once again, the next time I went and saw my doctor, I was going to have a talk with her about how messed up this is. So I go in to see the doctor a few months later to get my scripts filled again. She says, "Gotta drug test you." I go through the same spiel explaining things that she already knows to her about how this makes the war on drugs worse, how this makes the addiction crisis worse. I reminded her that she's building her relationship with her patients, many of whom might struggle with addiction at some point in their lives, on something other than trust. She is making sure that right away, if you come in here and I ask you if you're using drugs and you say no, I don't believe you. I don't trust you. Now, what sort of doctor-patient relationship is supposed to bloom from there? Seriously? Number two, you're adding financial burdens. My normal copay is $10, and suddenly it goes to $150. That's unsustainable. And number three, the real point, this is a way for doctors to fleece the system, to get a little bit more money from charging people for drug tests. And maybe worse, it's a way for them to Pontius Pilate wash the blood off their hands from the people that they're sending to the streets for drugs that they've been taking for years that were safe because they were getting them from their doctors and now will be anything but safe because they're going to do the logical, reasonable thing and get them on the streets for a dollar a pill instead of paying three times that at a doctor. That's not the way the system should work. Now, like I said, I actually thought this was just my doctor, but I talked to a close relative of mine the other day who's been on benzodiazepine doses for something like 15 years. Not even a heavy dose, but a daily dose, and she's used it to build a successful life. But suddenly, her doctor situation changed, and when she went to a new doctor to get her tried and true scripts filled, the ones that she's literally had for decades, the new doctor said, "Sorry, the best I can do is taper you off the benzodiazepines." Again, steering users to the street, which is the actual drug issue right now, the reason overdoses are through the roof. And this reminds me of what I've talked about a lot on this show. It isn't just the doctors. I mean, it's always been the doctors, but this new little snafu of adding extra hoops for drug users to jump through to just steer them to the streets where they can be locked up or killed instead of paying into a legitimate system, it's only the frosting on the cake. And here's the thing, because you can probably tell I'm annoyed about this, not just on a personal level, but because it's another step in the wrong direction when it comes to drug policy. I get why they're doing it. These massive settlements with Big Pharma that have now transcended all the way to the level of pharmacies like Walmart, where the government is coming after people who dispense legal drugs if they don't add extra hoops for people to jump through, it's now threatening doctors. And doctors are responding the way doctors do in industry, an institution. They're getting in line and putting new methods in place to show the status quo that we're still on board. They've got an opportunity here to say, we're not going to play these games. Drug users and especially addicted people need us more than ever. And instead, they're deliberately participating in policies that make sure that anybody that starts to struggle with addiction is likely to get out of there, go to the street, and totally remove themselves from professional help. When a system's built well, it makes sure that all the institutional power is incentivized to work together. I talked about this way back in episode 76 with civil asset forfeiture, which is why we live in a country where there's a backlog on sexual assault kits that haven't even been tested, and we have dozens of people in most jurisdictions who are trained to be soldiers who get paid way more than everybody else to kick in doors, throw flashbangs in, and arrest people for having substances they're not allowed to have. It's because they get to confiscate the money from the latter group and they don't get any money when they solve a sexual assault. That's a sad reality of how the legal system is currently set up, but we're seeing the same thing now with doctors. They just want to do business, get paid, and go home. And if that means they got to kick drug users to the street and some of us might die, in capitalism, who cares? And if you've listened to this show for long, you know that this is a theme that goes far beyond just the police and just the medical system. In fact, if you wanted to start from scratch and build a system that maximizes both the potential and the severity of addiction, you could not do a better job than what we already have in the United States. And that's what today's episode is about. Right now, the United States spends something like $300 billion every year on the criminal legal system, and a lot of that goes right to the war on drugs. U.S. drug users are also spending $150 billion out of our pockets every year to buy the drugs that are more illegal and more dangerous because of the war on drugs. And along the way, nothing has given. The price of drugs has stayed the same, despite more money spent on the drug war every year. The amount of drugs on the streets has always remained the same or increased. Every few years, there's a new drug that makes its way into the illegal supply. It's pretty obvious that what we're doing isn't working, and yet we're 100 years into doing it anyway. Now, the first thing you'd want to do if you were going to build a system that way is figure out a way to encourage people to use drugs irresponsibly. To not bother to figure out what they're going to do, how potent they are, to not make sure that they're in a safe set and setting to use that substance. And as I've been talking about for the last month or two on this show, our culture is literally designed to make us miserable, to make us feel compelled to go work meaningless jobs that don't feed our identity and make us feel disconnected from the products that we actually help create and distribute. That means that when we get off work, many of us are not fulfilled. I am very rare in my ability to work a job where I leave the prisons I teach at happy, feeling like I've accomplished something. You seldom get that when you work at McDonald's all day. So now we get off work and we realize, oh my God, I need something, a drink, a smoke, a Netflix binge to take my mind off the boredom that is work. We just check out. We're primed to seek out replacements for the contentment that we would otherwise get from our daily working lives. But we would want to do more than that, because the system's been that way for 100 years. We would also want to increase both the potency and the price of the drugs that people were using. Humans have been taking drugs like cannabis, opium, coca for thousands of years. We literally evolved side by side with them. And as long as we were using the actual raw chemicals that we evolved alongside, few people struggled with addiction at all. It's very rare to hear of somebody who's hopelessly addicted to chewing coca leaves or opium gum, the raw materials for producing cocaine and heroin, respectively. But capitalism, that system that I was just talking about, and that I've been talking about for a few weeks now, it drove us to find cheaper, more distilled products, like morphine to replace our opium gum, and like heroin later on to replace our morphine, and then fentanyl to replace the heroin with a synthetic alternative that's both far more potent and cheaper to manufacture. We didn't evolve side by side with these chemicals. So if we wanted to create an environment, a culture that maximized both the potential for addiction and the severity of addiction when it shows up, we would do what we've done with these drugs. We would make sure that they're illegal, they're super potent, and that they're expensive on the street compared to what they actually cost to produce. Cocaine or heroin cost $1 a gram to manufacture from the raw plant material that it comes from. Those same grams sell for hundreds of dollars on the street, which is why a war on drugs will never work. You could literally get 70% of all of the shipments that are smuggled in out of the equation with law enforcement, and there's still plenty of room for profit. Of course, nowadays it's worse than just the more potent chemicals that cost more, because in addition to having to struggle with whether the fentanyl I buy today from the same dealer on the same block that looks the same color and tastes the same will be 100 times stronger than it was yesterday, but now there's other substances added to these chemicals like xylazine to make our heroin last a little bit longer. These are chemicals that wouldn't be in our drugs if we were buying them in their pure, natural forms from legitimate dealers. So by steadily increasing the potency of drugs to the point where they're far past that of evolution, and then making sure that they cost way more than they ever would with the sort of constraints that would be put on them by things like capitalism or policy, we can drive the biology of addiction. But if we want to build a whole culture that drives addiction, we should go further, and we should also try to drive the emotional aspects of addiction. We can do that with hopelessness. Now, we know that hopelessness increases addiction in rats from studies that are 50 years old. B.F. Skinner did some of the original ones. But Bruce Alexander found that when you put rats in a cage that has toys and rats for them to mate with, they actually don't get addicted to drugs, even if they're readily available. Take the same rats and put them in a cage alone with no toys, in a cage they're unfamiliar with, and many of them will become hopelessly addicted to the drug, often using it to the point of death. So again, we would want to do what we've done in the United States, build a culture that instills this sense of hopelessness in the general public, and then leaves them with this special chemical on the top shelf that they know will work to make them feel a little bit better. As Johann Hari says in one of his old books, Chasing the Scream, about Harry Anslinger, totally recommend it. Addiction is a disease of loneliness and disconnection, of hopelessness. When our lives are filled with meaningful things and predictable, safe situations, most of us don't struggle with addictions at all because we get those same feelings, those same neural patterns firing from the events and the activities we're participating in. And even if we do use drugs regularly, we have alternative sources for those same feelings, so we don't find ourselves turning solely to the drugs. Get rid of all that and instill a sense of hopelessness, well, the drugs are right there, an obvious choice. Now there's a clue there, which is alternative sources of contentment, something else I've talked about a lot on this show. When I stopped using heroin, one of my biggest tricks was figuring out what the hell I was seeking out with that chemical. What was it doing in my brain that felt so irreplaceably great to me that I couldn't live without it? And I realized it was my thrill of the feast, this feeling that I had accomplished something, that my mom had patted me on the head and said, "Good job, you did it, I'm proud of you." And understanding that gave me a way to replace that with a much safer, much more consistent source. Now, it might not work as rapidly and as intensely as heroin does, but I still can activate those same brain circuits when I'm feeling a bit down, as an alternative to going back to the needle. Drugs don't do anything in humans except speed up or slow down things that are already happening. So in our hell culture, built to maximize the potential and the severity of addiction, alternative sources to the same speeding up or slowing down should be restricted, which is what we do with this thing we call tough love. We find out somebody's struggling, like I just explained, with feeling content, with feeling like they've accomplished something, and so they're turning to a chemical to mimic that feeling out of desperation. And what do? We fire them. We send them to rehab. We get mad at them and say, "How dare you?" We label them as having a disease. We do everything we can to make sure they have no alternative sources for what they're already turning to the chemical for. We couldn't build it worse if we tried. But we have built it worse, because I'm going to keep going. We would also want to not only make it so people were encouraged to use, but we would want to drive their use. We would want to make them use huge amounts if we really could. If there was some way to just make those folks who start using drugs to turn totally into the drugs and use as much as possible, well, then we'd be on to something. And again, it's not hard to see that's exactly what the United States has done. I'm going to go back to B.F. Skinner here again. One of his rat experiments was to see how often he could get a rat to push a button that would deliver the rat a food pellet. He tested whether if he gave the rat a food pellet every time it pushed the button, or whether he gave the rat a food pellet one out of every 10 times, or whether if he rewarded the rat in, say, some random pattern that was unpredictable, how often would the rat push the button? And what he discovered is the way that the United States is set up to drive consumption. If you reward the button-pushing rat randomly in unexpected and completely unpredictable patterns, the rat will push the button all the time. You can't get it to stop. Now think about the illegal drug market in the United States. As I already said, I may well buy the same dope in the same baggie from the same guy on the same corner for the same price as I did yesterday, and today it's 20 times stronger, and I overdose. Or I might buy it from him tomorrow, and it's really weak, and I don't even get high. Of course, in both of these situations, I'm seeking the same reward. I want that middle ground, nice buzz that gets me through a few hours, and in both cases, I'm going to be left very disappointed. By building it this way, we encourage those users to use more of the drug. We basically put them in a place where they have this conversation with themselves, with ourselves, because I'm an addict too, where we say, "I don't know the next time I'm actually going to be able to get high. I better use a little bit more right now." That finding's pretty damning to the war on drugs in and of itself. When animals, or presumably humans, take steady doses of a rewarding substance or food, we obviously go back the next time when we want that same feeling. When we go looking for something to eat or a good time, and we take a dose that gives us a bad time, even if it's something like, say, LSD and we have a challenging trip, we learn to avoid that thing the next time. Those two things are basic punishment theory using positive and negative reinforcement. We like something so we do it again. We don't like it so we don't do it again. Makes sense? But when we find something pleasant that makes us feel good, but it's inconsistent, unpredictable, and likely to be cut off at any time, we use more of it. We press the button that delivers the reward as many times as we can because we want to stockpile those rewards to prepare for the inevitable dry spell right around the corner. So unreliable potency and limited availability of drugs actually encourage use. There's even more we can do in our imaginary evil world. We could try to increase tolerance in users so they have to use more of the substance to get the same feeling they're looking for. Tolerance and sensitization are the bane of an addicted person's life. We hate them. If you can fix them, please tell us how. Tolerance is when we have to take more of a drug because the same amount as we took a few days ago doesn't get us as high anymore. And sensitization, conversely, is when we become more sensitive to a drug or a behavior or a situation. We notice it a lot earlier. You can think of sensitization like what happens to you when you start to notice the twitchy edginess of cocaine much earlier than you used to when you first took the drug. But tolerance is interesting in that it doesn't happen when we take a drug. It happens before we take a drug, when we pull out our kit to cook up, or when we smell the drug, or when we break down the blunt wrapper and hear that pop, 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 or when we boil our dope in the spoon and hear the sizzle. It happens as soon as we get to the dope house and see the paint, or when we catch sight of our dealer, or when we turn into their neighborhood from the freeway, or when we show up at the methadone clinic, or when we enter the pharmacy to pick up our pills, or when we walk into the restaurant to order a meal. Our bodies notice clues that something is about to happen, and then they adjust their chemistry in an effort to prepare for that thing that they think is going to happen. That means every time we experience something, our body marks it as what will possibly happen the next time the precursors to that thing show up. Our brains say, I've heard that bubbling and that smell of sweet tea before. I think we might have a dose of heroin coming. Let's turn up the anti-opioids so we can protect ourselves from an overdose. That's what brains do. And again, it sucks when you're an addicted person, even though it saves our lives. This is why set and setting are so important. Drugs affect us differently depending on where we use them, when we use them, and who we're with. Change just one of those things, like some studies do with rats who take large daily doses of heroin by simply moving them from their familiar cage to one with the walls painted a different color, and they die from overdose simply because the colors of the room are different and their bodies can't get used to the situation and recognize the clues of an incoming dose. It's almost like their body has said, when I'm in a red room and I notice a bubbling of dope and the smell of heroin, I need anti-opioids to kick in to protect me from an overdose. And then the next day it says, I smell that sweet tea, I hear the bubbling, but you know what? No red walls. There must not be any heroin coming. Now the clue here is that if we really wanted to make sure people could tolerate their drugs, we would make sure they're using in a reliable, safe space where they use at the same place most of the time so that their brains can recognize clues of an incoming dose. And it's not hard to notice that once again, I'm talking about something the United States does the opposite of. We make sure people have to jump into the subway bathroom to shoot up real quick, or smoke crack under a bridge turned against the corner to block the wind, and then jump right back onto the sidewalk and keep walking. We force people to hide their use, to lie about it, to use in unfamiliar places in rapid ways without paying much attention to what they're doing. We increase their risk of overdose. And finally, something that's been on my heart for a long time, since maybe the first episode of this show, outlawing safe use locations increases overdose and addiction. When safe use sites for a substance exists, people have an incentive to go to those safe use sites. And the reason they're called safe use sites is because there is support there. No one has ever died from a drug overdose at a safe use site in their operating history. Not just in the United States, but in the world. But when these locations don't exist, not only do people use without oversight and protection that might save them in the event of an overdose, but it's a mental thing in that the penalty for using is the same everywhere. There's no reason to go to the safe use site to cover your butt because you could be arrested in that building the same as you can be arrested anywhere. So why not just shoot up under that bridge? By just taking the simple and obvious first step of opening safe use sites for drug users, we can put people who are using drugs in contact with people who will support them. People who, if they do overdose, will not only bring them back, but will say, I'm glad you're here. Is this a wake-up call to maybe seek some alternative services? Do you want to go to therapy? Do you want to try methadone? That doesn't happen on the streets. I'm not only annoyed that the system has deliberately been built this way for more than 100 years, but I'm annoyed that we're making it worse right now. We're recruiting the doctors to fight with the government, to send drug users who have been long using safe drugs from reliable sources to the street for unsafe drugs that they can get for a cheaper price and they don't have to pee in a cup for their drug dealer. Our doctors should be on our team. The government should be here to protect us, not to make our lives more difficult, not to lock us up, not to tax the hell out of us to fight a war against chemicals we're spending $150 billion a year to buy anyway. But for now, the United States is literally built in a way that maximizes the potential and the severity of addictions. And it's time for us to recognize that and do something about it. One of my favorite mentors used to tell me, don't offer big problems without at least offering some sort of solution. So let's summarize the problem first. We've got a culture built in a way that makes drug use very inviting to many who live in that culture. We've talked about the specifics for months now on this podcast. Worse, we've also built that culture to deal with addiction in a way that ensures it will be as frequent and as deadly as possible. As soon as someone resorts to using a drug, we press them out of spaces where they might find happiness and fulfillment, things that might reduce their use. Then we make sure they can't access any sort of low-dose, labeled, affordable supply of whatever drug it is that they're resorting to using, and we instead send them to the streets, where the iron law of prohibition makes sure that they'll pay thousands of percent markups for polluted drugs that can't be returned or reported to the BBB if they're poison or fake. In short, we look at those who resort to using a chemical to change how they feel because how they feel is so bad they want to change it. And instead of us feeling empathy and offering a hug and a friendly ear, we feel disgust and we judge them as selfish, sinful, and inferior. At best, we label them as diseased and we keep them at arm's length. At worst, we lock them in a prison cell and block them out of society. The solution is in that summary. These last few episodes have focused on the power of language to reveal how we think and to shape how we think. We've got to change how we feel about drugs and drug users if we ever want to kick them out of our prisons and reincorporate them into our culture. They're just people who found a switch that helps them feel better for a little while. Focusing on that switch and on how we think about that switch, that's a great place to start. So yes, we need systemic overhaul to incorporate all those services I mentioned earlier, which will be automatic once we get our drugs from doctors and pharmacies instead of dealers. But addicted people also need our friends and family members to do their homework and to understand what's going on when someone is using drugs in an irresponsible way, or when they're using drugs at all for that matter. It sounds simple, but the biggest trick of the war on drugs has always been to hijack the public's thoughts, to force us to imagine something very different than an injured Civil War vet or than people struggling with emotional issues when we think about a drug user. We just got to get back to the basics and remember who it is that we're talking about. Thanks for listening. I'm Ben Boyce.